This is Leading Lines. I'm Derek Bruff. A few years ago, I learned about a board game called Monarch. In the game, players compete to be the heir to the throne. Through feeding and taxing the citizens of their fictional kingdom, players collect weapons and treasures and followers in an effort to build the most impressive court and win the favor of the dying monarch. The game is cleverly designed and has really amazing art, but what makes it different is that all the characters are women. The dying monarch is the queen, and players are princesses striving to show their wisdom and strength. This game upends some traditional stereotypes, and it does so quite intentionally. The designer is Mary Flanagan, and when I looked her up, I was surprised to learn that she's a professor at Dartmouth College, where she runs a game design and research lab called Tilt Factor. Flanagan and her team design games for social change, like Monarch, and they investigate their effects on players' beliefs and behaviors. I had the chance to visit Dartmouth this August, and I reached out to Flanagan to see if I could stop by her game lab and learn more about their work. Flanagan was off campus, but Tilt Factor's senior game designer, Max Seidman, was on hand to give me a tour of the lab and to talk with me about games and learning.
So, Tilt Factor is Professor Mary Flanagan's game design and research lab here at Dartmouth.
Okay.
Here we do three things. We study games, we make games, and kind of more specifically than that, the games we make are all for social change.
Okay.
So that can mean a whole host of different things. So some examples are, we've got Pox and Zombie Pox, which were some board games that we made at the request of the Massacoma Valley Health Initiative a while back.
Okay.
To encourage players to get vaccinated.
Wow. Okay.
So once we make these games, we make them with a goal in mind, and then we do research to see, are they doing what we want them to be doing? Of course, there's research beforehand, too, to figure out how they're going to do what we want them to be doing.
Yeah.
In the case of Pox and Zombie Pox, we did a study where we compared Pox to Zombie Pox to an iPad version of Pox.
Okay.
And to a control version of the game, or control condition where they didn't play the game. We found that after playing, players had more positive attitudes towards vaccination in the Pox and Zombie Pox conditions. But we found that that wasn't the case in the iPad version. So this is a great example of where first we learned something. We verified the efficacy of the game, right?
Okay.
We knew what the game was doing. We knew that it was encouraging people to get vaccinated. They had more positive attitudes afterwards. We learned something interesting about narrative. We actually found that the Zombie Pox version had players had more positive, more empathy towards people with infectious diseases than the vanilla version. So that zombies narrative did something.
Okay.
And then we found something about the medium, right? We found the iPad version actually didn't have those effects.
All three games had the same mechanics?
Yes. In fact, all three games had the same mechanics and were played identically.
Okay. Zombiepox had a different theme.
Different theme, yep.
Right.
And the iPad version was still played like a board game between two players.
Okay.
In addition, we actually, if you go and find the iPad version on the App Store or compare it to the Zombiepox version we've made, you'll see that you wouldn't see, but the study versions were different to make them more controlled. So, for example, in the iPad game, it's a cooperative game where players are trying to contain the disease in all cases. But in the iPad game, as you'd kind of expect, the disease is played by the computer. It automatically spreads, it automatically infects people. In the board games versions, you have to play as the disease as well. So for the study version of the iPad game, you actually had to play as the disease.
Okay.
And we actually kind of broke some digital game conventions there. So, for example, you actually had to choose characters you wanted to put the various tokens on, just like you would with the board game. There were no sound effects, none of the bells and whistles that you'd expect in a digital game. Similarly, in the commercial Zombiepox version, the people who die turn into zombies and can then spread the disease. In the vanilla version, the people who die cannot spread the disease.
Right. That's usually
how it
works.
So trying to keep it as controlled as possible.
Sure.
So we learned a whole bunch of really interesting things there, with the last bit being that the digital version didn't have an effect.
Interesting.
That launched a whole bunch of separate research. So it was kind of the core, is the game doing what we expect it to be doing?
Mm-hmm.
And then secondarily, what have we learned about that? What can we tell other people about this process? And we've learned mm-hmm. that digital games are not always don't always have the same effect as
sure.
non-digital
okay.
ones. So that's one area of social change, is public health.
Okay.
Another big area for us is biases, social biases. So that started a while back with, I think it was probably 2010 or 2011, for a project that eventually became Buffalo and Awkward Moment.
Okay.
So these were games to combat gender bias in science, technology, engineering, and math fields. And specifically, so Awkward Moment kind of plays like Cards Against Humanity, the PG version.
Okay.
It was made at the same time, so they both ripped off apples to apples.
Right, yes.
and in it, you draw a awkward social situation, like You see your friend coming down the street towards you, so you wave like crazy and call her name, and it turns out it's not your friend.
Gotcha.
Everyone has done that, right?
Right.
Then everyone has a hand of reactions that range from silly to serious, appropriate to completely inappropriate for the situation. My particular favorite for that one is fix your hair. So, you know, you do the wave and then turn it into running your fingers through your
right.
hair.
Right, yeah.
One player plays as the judge. They actually given a criteria, so like most appropriate, most likely to work, funniest, that sort of thing. They choose whichever they think is funniest or most likely to work, whatever. And that player who played that reaction, of course, gets the moment card, and that's a point.
Okay.
This was targeted at middle schoolers, so a lot of the middle school moments are middle school targeted. What we found here is, so a subset of the moments, around 30%, have something to do with gender bias, bias in STEM, gender bias in STEM, or just other sorts of bias.
Okay.
Those are things like you see a store at the mall selling T-shirts for girls that say math is hard. This was ripped from the headlines a while ago. I think it was
sure.
JCPenney.
Yeah.
And
then
everyone gets to react to that, right? And those range from that, which is fairly light, to slightly heavier, not a heck of a lot heavier. We found that after playing this game, players tripled their associations between women and science. The question we always get asked is, how do you measure these things?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, in a perfect world, all of our measures would be behavioral, like we'd, you know, stage a bias incident, see if they intervene sort of thing. That's
right.
Very hard to do for certain topics. In POC, so actually the ideal case would have been we actually see if they go get vaccinated. Longitudinal studies are expensive, and this was an unfunded project, so we just made it from the Escoma Valley Health Initiative. So instead, we did attitudes. In this one, in Ockerbone, we actually used a very clever measure that Dr. Jeff Kaufman came up with. We had six psychologically validated neutral faces, three men, three women, and we said these are upcoming characters in a new game, match the character to the profession.
Oh, wow.
So the group who didn't play the game said that matched the one of the women to the scientist profession around 20% of the time. The players who did play the game matched around 60% of the time, which is exactly what we wanted.
Okay.
We also found other cool things, right? Because we always are finding other cool
things. What was the time frame on the pre and post there?
So that wasn't pre-post.
Or
that
no,
was
or
hanging
pre-post.
Control versus no versus game.
Okay.
So it was immediately after the game, but it was compared to players who didn't play at all.
Gotcha.
And this was, again, with middle schoolers. One of the really other interesting things we found, which is kind of speaks to the efficacy of games in general, is after playing, players had much more, took other people's perspectives much more. They were in the other perspective mode, and there's some interesting tests where you draw an E on your forehead for that one. And if you draw it so that it's a right side, the right way for you, you're in your self perspective.
Okay.
If you draw it the other way, you're in other perspective.
Right.
And we found that.
Yeah, someone to call someone else a loser too. And
you could do the L.
You might get that.
We found that players, let's see, for adults, I think it went from something like 40% to 100% of the players, were like close to 100% of the players were in other perspective after playing the game.
Wow.
Which makes sense, because in these board tabletop games where you're thinking about what other players are doing, you have to take their perspectives. Even more strikingly...
Oh, sure, because you're not only imagining yourself in some situation that may involve other people,
right.
but you're also interacting socially around the table
yes.
and trying to figure out how can I get a vote from this
exactly,
person?
Exactly.
Right?
What are they going to think is funny? What are they going to think is appropriate? And that's true in most games, even if they're not doing this particular mechanic, right?
Sure.
What is that other player going to do on their turn? Even more strikingly, we found it, so that was in adults. In kids, we found it jumped from something like 20 to 80%, which is even more impressive, seeing as kids are very bad at taking other people's perspectives.
Right.
And they
don't
do that a lot.
Yeah.
That's Awkward Moment. And Buffalo was really even more interesting in my, or actually, so a whole bunch of other things we found, actually. More important than Awkward Moment, and a lot of our papers came from this, we found that, what happens if you put more biased moments in the game, right? You can make a more effective game, right?
Right, because you said about 30% of the
So we did a
encounters.
Version where we said 90%. That overloaded it. People immediately figured out what was going on in the game, and it wiped away all the effects.
Wow, right.
Perhaps not the perspective-taking ones. I don't think we measured those in that particular study.
Okay.
But it did take away the bias-reducing effect.
Mm-hmm.
This shouldn't surprise people, but it does.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
if a game is just loaded with impactful content, quote unquote, it can overload and backfire. And so Buffalo, same project, actually has been shown to reduce
right.
prejudice.
Right. So you put the broccoli in the mac and cheese. You don't just serve up nothing.
Here's
but
broccoli.
The broccoli. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. A little bit of broccoli is nice. Just broccoli is not mac and cheese anymore.
Right, right.
And so Buffalo is a fun one that's super, super light. Can you name a British princess?
Diana, that was easy.
You get the cards, 2 points.
Yay!
Whoever has the most points at the end wins. And we found shown that this game actually reduces players' prejudices in general. So it was targeted towards women in STEM.
Okay.
And we found it actually reduces prejudice across the board using a couple of measures, the universal orientation measure and the social entity complexity measure, both of which are measures of non-prejudice.
Okay. So, and I looked into Buffalo, so the mechanic here is that the adjective and the noun will kind of combo together in interesting ways,
yes,
where you may have to think of someone
pairs.
Who's... Say that again?
Counter-stereotypic pairs.
That's great. I love that.
So, like, while you're playing, you're going to... So, we seeded the deck with a lot of feminine and also just female cards, and then
okay.
We also seeded the deck with a bunch of sciences. But in addition to the various female scientists that you're going to have to name, you're also going to have to perhaps name... nerdy athletes, that is a counter-stereotypic pair, or generous CEOs, another counter-stereotypic pair. And even if you can't name them, oftentimes somebody at the table will be able to name them.
Okay.
And so that's the mechanism here. We think that, so we actually haven't done a mechanism study, we don't know exactly what it is, but we're pretty certain it's about the recall ability, so when you or someone else names them, that's useful, and also the inability initially, when you're stumped, that can also perhaps... make you feel a little bad about that, or make you feel like, oh, I know this person. There's somebody in my head. I just can't name
sure.
them.
Yeah, yeah.
And that again brings up the kind of the salience of that lack, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's Buffalo. That's biases, and we're doing a whole bunch more projects on bias. That's kind of one of our biggest areas.
Okay. And Buffalo, I'm guessing, like Awkward Moment, that kind of counter stereotype pair. Is that what you said?
Counter stereotypic pair. Yeah.
Counter-stereotypic pair?
Sure.
That's great.
I don't know if it's right. That's just what Jeff says, and I quote
okay.
him.
I like that phrase. Anyway, that might only come up 30-40% of the time, right? I mean, there's a randomness
less.
To
way,
it.
Way, way less.
Okay.
I think 10 or 20 probably.
Okay.
I haven't actually done the math, but
sure.
The decks have 200 cards each, and they will certainly come up during the course of the game, but we're pretty sure that one of the reasons it's working is because of that perception of randomness, right?
Yeah.
We can't be preaching to you as the
right.
creators of the game, because these decks are random. You could have drawn anything. How do we know you were going to draw a
right.
female scientist? Only
right.
because
right.
there happened to be, you know, 4 or 5 female cards and
sure.
6 or 7 science fields.
Yeah. Can you tell me about Monarch? Because I actually own that one.
Yes. So Monarch is actually... So, sidestep. Made Buffalo and Awkward Moment. They're these cool games. We found they were doing something. They looked good. People had fun with them. What do we do with that? The typical research lab says, we publish a paper. We're done.
Right.
But not Professor Flanagan. She wants to get them out in the world because they're doing great things and they're fun.
Right.
So
social change.
Eventually, yeah. Eventually we formed a side company called Resonim that publishes the tabletop games, because it turns out it's expensive to make tabletop games, and they also don't make very much money.
Right.
So you can sell them, make some money, and then use that to print the next run.
Right. This is why Kickstarter is used to fund board games, because
yes.
it's a risky financial venture.
Yes. It doesn't take quite as much startup funding as making a digital game, perhaps.
Sure.
So... Monarch is actually just Professor Flanagan's brainchild, and she came up with this concept of this game. We did do a little bit of research on it, but it wasn't one of our grant-funded projects.
Okay.
In the game, you play as the daughters of the queen. Your mother is dying. She's going to pass on the crown to the most worthy among you. And you prove yourself worthy by basically governing the lands. It's kind of a counterpoint to the stereotypical princess story. Right, with all those trappings are in there, but you also get a lot of the important, like, let's improve the actual queendom, I guess, for all the residents or all your underlings, I guess. And of course, you all play as women.
Right.
So one of the research we did on this was, again, is it affecting gender bias, or just gender identity in general.
Mm-hmm.
And so we brought it to some boys boarding schools, all boys boarding schools.
Yes.
And there's some research that says, and this is actually Dr. Kaufman's research again, if you're reading a story, it's in first person, let's say, and we're trying to get you to empathize with the main character. If that character shares has an outgroup from you, so he did research where that character was a woman and the readers were men, he did research where that character was from a particular university and the readers were from a different university.
Okay.
Just any sort of outgroup. If you tell people about that up front, so immediately that you reveal that the character goes to this university or whatever, that kind of makes it hard for you to actually connect with that character and take their experience. I think the outcome is experience taking is what it's called.
Okay.
But if you delay that reveal, so you read a chapter, and then at the beginning of the second chapter you reveal what university they go to. It's too late. You've already connected with that character.
Okay.
And even more interestingly, you can get readers to be more likely to do things that character did in the delayed reveal. I think one of the bits of research they did was readers were more likely to vote.
Mm-hmm.
If the character voted in the delayed reveal.
Okay. Yeah.
And you can also build more connection to that character and reduce bias. So in one of the, I think, gender ones, players showed more empathy towards the character. They, I think, also perhaps just showed less gender bias in general in that delayed reveal again. So in Monarch, back to Monarch, we played with these, we had these middle schoolers play. They were all boys. And in one condition, we seeded the deck, we stacked the deck such that it wasn't clear immediately that you were women. In the other condition, it was clear very immediately. There are some gowns in the deck that we had come up either earlier or later. There are some cards that refer to the players as sisters.
Okay.
Had those come up earlier or later.
Okay.
And we found the same thing, that in that delayed reveal, while it was, from watching, we wouldn't have expected this. There was a kind of like a pushback when they drew those cards. They're like, sisters? Well, I'm not a sister. Once they figured it out, the game continued smoothly, and the measures afterwards found that they were more, I believe it was more likely to rate themselves higher on traditionally feminine traits after playing the game than the boys who got that reveal immediately.
Gotcha. Okay. And when you taught the boys the game,
yep.
you didn't tell them the backstory, yep. right?
We definitely scrubbed the gender out there. We probably just did, the monarch is dying.
Right.
And
you were the child of the monarch.
You're the children.
You just gender neutralized
exactly.
the story.
Exactly. I don't remember exactly how we did it, but we definitely did. Cool. Those are some of the big areas of focus. Some other stuff we've done. We've done games to combat climate change, in which we've been able to get people to recycle. We've done games to to promote bystander intervention in sexual assault on college campuses.
Wow.
We've done games to crowdsource data collection for libraries and archives. So I can talk about any of those, but
wow.
those are some of the other things we've done as well.
That's great. Well, tell you what, let's maybe sit somewhere.
Yeah.
And
let's take the classroom.
And I can ask a few follow-up questions.
After our tour of the Tilt Factor lab, I sat down with Max Seidman to discuss more of Tilt Factor's research into games and social change. A quick note before we go to the interview. Max talks about a game called Replay Health, a simulation designed to teach players about the healthcare system. We discussed that game at length in the last episode of Leading Lines during my interview with Dartmouth sociologist Kimberly Rogers. So check out that episode if you'd like more info on Replay Health and how it works in the classroom. Now here's my interview with Max.
So actually, I took Professor Flanagan's game design class. Dartmouth has two, maybe three game-related classes. Mary teaches most of them, at least two of them. And one of her classes is Game Design Studio. And it's basically, the students are challenged to make a game a week for the 10-week term. And it's kind of like a crash course in what we do at Tilt Factor.
Okay.
So they are all socially focused in some way. Games about bullying.
Game a week.
Game a week.
Okay.
They're mostly tabletop games. I think one or two of them can be mock-ups of digital games. And they playtest them, and they break them, and then they bring them in. They present them. The students play them, and then they move on. Over the course, they get a few chances to revise some of the past ones, which is fun. And so I had always loved particularly tabletop games. I played Catan when I was probably 7, Puerto Rico when I was probably 10, and I'd always been playing tabletop games as well as digital games, but I never thought there was actually an opportunity to, you know, have a career making them.
Yeah.
So I took took Professor Flanagan's class probably my freshman year, maybe my sophomore year, and after that I said, how can I get involved? And I volunteered at Tilt Factor. This was when we were still in the other space. And then after that, I became an intern, and I did some work for Tilt Factor. Buffalo was when I was an intern.
Okay.
Awkward Moment was not me, but I was involved. Pox was the game I worked on when I was volunteering. And then after that, I was getting ready to graduate. I was looking for stuff in human-centered design because I was an engineering major here at Dartmouth, and did a lot of the human-centered design-focused stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happened, Tilt Factor was being approached to do some medical games that I got involved in, so I became a game designer on that. And then there was another project, and then there was another project, and here we are.
Yeah.
It's been 5 years now since I've been here full-time.
Yeah,
so yeah, it's
yeah.
been a while.
That's a career.
Hopefully.
Yeah. I'd love to hear a little bit more maybe about Replay Health and what are the mechanisms in a game like that that are meant to educate or inform or promote change?
Right. So Replay Health was based off of a simulation, Rethink Health, that was made by the Ripple Foundation, I think. And they had this very kind of intricate simulation that was based on lots of big data, right? They gathered what things change in a community if they impose taxes on smoking, what things change in the community if they do this, what things change in the community if they do that. And it was a really interesting tool that they would gather community health stakeholders together to play with the simulation and see like how do healthcare costs change, how does quality go up or down. But it's a very intensive experience, right? Mm-hmm. Not only does it need to be customized for the location if they want to actually base it off of fact, but also it's a simulation. It's a hard thing to use because there's lots of really interesting data going on there.
Okay. So here the simulation is meant like when you run a computer simulation and you want to see what's the weather going to be in 3 days, right? Like they're actually doing a lot of modeling there.
Exactly.
And you have people help to kind of play it out and see what the dynamics are.
And they can do things like allocate funds. They can say, okay, what if we put the funding in this initiative and that initiative? How is that going to change our healthcare quality and cost in 5 years and 10 years, whatever? Replay Health was built to basically be a more kind of embodied, more about the feeling than the numbers, right? That's kind of one of the things that we find games do really well in general. It's not about the specific numbers. For example, in Pox, herd immunity occurs in reality at something like 85 to 95% of the population being immunized, depending on what the disease is, obviously. And one of the early decisions we made in Pox was that can't be our end goal. It's not fun, but it's also not important. We're not trying to convey that percentage to them, right? We're trying to convey that the concept is important.
Gotcha. So it doesn't matter if players walk away knowing that herd immunity occurs at 85%.
Exactly.
It matters that they walk away valuing herd immunity.
That they walk away thinking, oh, if I get vaccinated, I'm not just protecting me, I'm protecting everyone around me, particularly the people who can't get vaccinated. Similarly, in Replay Health, we went from Rethink Health, where the numbers are really important, and we said, okay, what if we centered on the kind of values and the concepts more than the numbers? We wanted to do things like convey that health is not a good by itself. Health is only good in that it lets you do the things you want to do. We wanted to focus on concepts of kind of systemic problems. So lack of healthy foods to eat. Oftentimes, food deserts is a systemic problem, not a personal problem. So we wanted to shift kind of players' thoughts away from the personal causes of health towards the systemic. And there are a whole bunch of little things in there as well. We wanted to talk about kind of how finances work. We wanted to talk about a whole bunch of different types of interventions going on. And so what goes on in the game is, like I said, it plays like
blockchain. It sounds like the goal there is a little more educational in nature than some of the other games you described where you're trying to kind of change people's perceptions or change their biases.
I would argue that they're all, it's all kind of perceptions. That with Replay Health, we're trying to change perceptions of who's at fault for bad health, for example, for low quality health, right? We wanted to change. Yeah, I mean, there were some educational elements, and I can talk about some of the initiatives that we modeled in the game, and how those were certainly educational because they actually may be introducing new concepts to the players that they've never seen before.
How do you measure benefit with a game like Replay Health?
Right. So as I've mentioned earlier, behavioral measure is always the gold standard. Yeah. And sometimes we're able to do that, sometimes we aren't. For something like this, measuring, there's not much of a way you can measure how much a player attributes the causes of health to systemic versus personal other than psych surveys. Okay. And so in addition to our kind of media creation folks and our game expertise, we also have social psych expertise. And our social psychologists basically find or invent measures to measure this kind of stuff. I would actually have to dig up some of the measures for Replay Health. But it was something along the lines of, I believe we did a measure that was the person got a hamburger, ate a cheeseburger at McDonald's for lunch because, and left them fill in the blank. That's an example of how we might measure things like self versus systemic attribution. So we would then analyze what they said. And if they said it was, you know, because he was hungry, there's a little bit of self. It could be something like, in the context of health, they might well say something like, because he didn't have access to anything better.
Okay.
Or because it was cheap, for example. Those are some systemic reasons. And we have a whole host of those for all the various things that we're talking about. We also measured how positively players thought of the interventions modeled in the game compared to some that were not modeled in the game. So this is a while ago. I'm trying to dredge up the measures. But so players were more positive towards the ones that they had seen modeled in the game, which is kind of what our goal was, right? We were modeling things that we want players to know about and kind of keep in their mind, especially if they're community health stakeholders, right?
Sure.
They should be aware of that they could try to capture and reinvest these savings from healthcare.
Right. These are things they could propose or support before.
Yeah. We did a version of Cards Against Humanity that we called Cops Arrest Manatees. And it was all about making
Cops
fun of climate change.
Cops Arrest Manatees?
Yes. Okay. Cops Arrest Manatees. And it was about making fun of climate change. So in Cops Arrest Manatees, players were, only, again, like some of the other games, only a subset of the things had anything to do with climate change. And those that did, we tried to build them so that they could be made fun of, right? It wasn't just like, we are killing the planet. It's what is the next generation of cars powered by? Like, ground-up hippies is one of the answers, for example. And what we were trying to get people to do is be more environmentally conscious. But this one was actually a behavioral measure. We gave people plastic cups at the beginning of the study. This was actually in a pub. So we gave them, poured them water, drink some water, whatever. Played the game. Yeah, end of the game. If you guys could just clear the cups off your table. We have a recycling bin and a trash bin over by the front. We see who recycles and who doesn't.
Wow.
We used invisible ink on the cups to tell which participants recycled and which ones didn't. We found that players recycled 25%, I believe 25% more of the time. No, I think they recycled 25% of the time if they had played the game and 10% if they hadn't. Which is unfortunate that it's that low, but it was a jump.
Right, but that's real behavior change.
It is real
behavior
change.
One game,
exactly.
Right? I mean, it's a short-term behavior change, right?
Yes.
But something's happening there.
Yes, and on that topic, replay health may or may not work this way, but some of the kind of more traditional card and board games, the benefit of those is they are replayable. Mm-hmm. So unlike most other types of interventions, right? You know, the read this story intervention, the whatever it is, hear this lecture intervention, if you give people a game of Cops vs. Manatees and they like it, they're going to play it again. And so while you may have a kind of spike after playing that then dribbles off, if they play again, you're hopefully going to get that spike again.
Sure.
That's kind of one of the reasons why we've drifted towards replayable tabletop and digital games.
Okay. And there I think the game is part of it, right? Like if it weren't fun, they wouldn't do it again.
Exactly.
Right? So it needs to be fun.
Yes.
Right? While also having some mechanics or thematic elements that kind of move them in a
certain way. Most fun game in the world is... The most impactful game in the world is worthless if it's not also fun, because people are just not going to play it.
Sure, let me ask just a minute. You mentioned kind of tabletop and kind of replayable games. You guys do a fair amount with digital games as well.
Yes.
Right? And so do you think about those differently and how they might affect social change or education?
Absolutely. So this was, again, the POCS study where we compared the non-digital POCS to the digital POCS. We launched a whole bunch of research on what the heck's going on there. Why are those things different? And our current understanding is that even beyond all the obvious stuff, what's going on with POCS and the digital POCS seems to be a control-level theory. So basically, if you have... I hope I get this right. High control level... means that you are paying attention to you're in a kind of an abstract mindset, you're paying attention to the big picture. And low construal level means you are in a very concrete mindset, you're paying attention to the little details. Now, both of these are very useful, but it seems that, from our study, players are more focused on the details when interacting with digital media, and more focused on the abstract when interacting with non-digital media. Obviously, this is very important, and we haven't 100% found ways around this yet. We also don't know what's causing it. Why is this the case?
Okay.
But it's a thing to be aware of, right? So we think one of the reasons that POCS, the digital POCS version, didn't have the same effect as the tabletop one is because players were figuring on the kind of little, where am I putting my vaccinations? Mm-hmm. How am I vaccinating this community? how am I dealing with the sickness? And much less on the, oh, when most people are vaccinated, the disease cannot spread anymore. So we're getting that, we think we're getting that herd immunity realization at the high control levels, but not at the low control levels.
So when you're in the kind of macro mode, it's harder to see those. When you're in the micro mode, it's harder to see the macro stuff.
Yeah.
Right? And something about the digital version kind of moves people into that.
Yes.
You call low control levels.
Yeah.
The micro mode. Very interesting. So are there, can you use that to your advantage? Are there kind of low control level learning that you'd like people
there absolutely
to have
are. I don't know what they are.
Okay.
But certainly it's not that high control level is good and low control level is bad.
Right.
It's just that it just so happens that many of the things we're trying to affect happen to be high control level.
Things. Well, and it's again kind of in the education world, you know, we talk about the details in the big picture and how students bring to class certain ways of organizing information and knowledge. Often novices in a discipline have kind of lightly connected networks of, you know, concepts and ideas and examples. And as they develop expertise in a particular domain, they start to kind of put those together in really robust ways. And so they're able to kind of see how things are connected. They're able to see that big picture better. And I think if you look at like a freshman chemistry class, and you just start paging through the textbook, it feels like it's all what you might call low control level. It's all details at that point.
Right.
And it's hard for a novice in that discipline to kind of see how all those details fit together. And so we are often advising faculty to find ways to take students up to that high control level and see the big picture and see how things are connected and related.
And maybe that means digital textbooks aren't a good idea for that kind of stuff.
Maybe.
We haven't studied textbooks. I'm not going to say that this is the case,
sure.
But for games.
But I think for instructors who are looking to move their students to that kind of big picture level to think about an analog game of some sort. Like there's an argument to be made there that they're
absolutely
a tool in that case.
Absolutely. We also found, I think this one was less significant, but I certainly noticed it when we were conducting these studies, that players lost a lot more in the digital version.
They were just worse at the game.
They were just worse at the game.
And so
subsequent studies that used like riddles and didn't use games also found similar things on the control level stuff. But I was just seeing, they're not doing as well at the game with this detail focus, perhaps because of this detail focus.
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually kind of anecdotally seen that as well when playing digital versions of tabletop games. I certainly personally interact with them way differently than I would the tabletop versions.
Yeah.
And again, part of that's because they're different artifacts, right? They're designed for different mediums, but like also it could be just perhaps because I'm used to, playing games very quickly and unthinkingly on mobile, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'm playing a strategy game, that's not going to be in my favor.
Sure, because you need some of that big picture thinking in order to actually
do any sort of strategy. Yeah.
Whereas
a traditional mobile game may be less strategic and may require less of that. Again, the lowest control level then may work in its favor.
Sure. Well, and I think about some of the mobile games that are super popular aren't asking for strategy. It's
right.
All what you see on the screen right now and how you connect colors and things.
Honestly,
like that.
Most of the digital games that are super popular are not asking for strategy at all.
Right. Any advice you'd give for an educator who's wanting to bring them into their classroom or maybe design a game?
Oh boy. The designing one is very hard. We spend our life doing that, right? So my personal understanding of the way games are effective is they make players feel like they have agency over the subject matter. So this is probably a good thing for education in general. And it's a good thing in many circumstances. In some, however, it's not. So it's good for people to feel agency over climate change. Because they will feel less of the kind of helplessness that they get from this massive problem, right? And it's good for people to feel agency over maybe their own biases. Because the way you reduce bias is first you learn you have it, and then you put up a filter to think before you speak.
Mm-hmm.
And then that slowly trains yourself to you know, reduce that bias. But some things maybe like poverty in others, for example, may not be good to make people who are not in poverty feel like they have agency over poverty. There was a recent game study on the game Spent, in which players play as someone who's in poverty and trying to keep afloat and make decisions. And the study found that players actually had less empathy towards people in poverty after playing. And my understanding, my take on that, and the reason I think that's happening, and the reason I think that's probably happening in a lot of games too, is that after playing, they felt like, oh, cool. If I mean, yeah, I lost, but if I'd just done a little better, I would have won. You now feel like you have agency over poverty, and you feel like people who are in poverty just really need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. So think about what you're making people feel, what the, you're making the players feel agency over.
That's really great advice.
It's one of the things that we think about a lot.
Yeah, because I know folks at my campus who recommend that people play that game instead.
It's a great game. It does a really good job. Like, it shows a bunch of really interesting concepts, but in some ways it seems like it might backfire.
Mm-hmm. Right, and it may even, it's possible that it could help with understanding how certain things play out, but decrease empathy in some, at
yes,
the same time.
That's very, very possible.
Okay. Whereas with something like we play health, you actually do want people to think,
oh, yeah,
if we do this again, can we do it better?
Right.
How can we improve our own communities?
Exactly.
By taking that agency.
After they're playing, they're saying, we can improve our communities, which is very much true, especially for healthcare stakeholders, and really, honestly, for regular people, too.
Yeah.
They should go in and say, come out of that game saying, you know, we really need more parks and walking paths, because now that I think about it, the reason I'm at home all the time because it's not easy for me to get anywhere to walk around.
Yeah.
There's no sidewalk from Dartmouth to Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. You got to drive.
Right. So I'll end with a question we ask all of our guests. Although you're not an educator, so this is I'll let you just answer it. And
I can read.
You can read. So on our podcast, Leading Lines, we focus a lot on digital educational technologies of various kinds. Our conversation has actually talked more about kind of analog space. Do you have any favorite analog educational technologies?
That's a good question.
Let me reframe it.
Yeah.
Okay. So you guys are maybe, I don't know about your process, but I'm imagining there are points in your game design process where you find a problem in the game. It's not working the way that you hope it to, and you have to do some creative problem solving. What's an analog technology you use to help your team solve problems creatively?
Whiteboards.
Yeah.
There's an analog technology we use.
Yeah.
The creative process is always baffling to me, and like the solution, more often than not, is sleep on it, go take a shower, go walk around, go walk someplace new. It certainly works for me and our team. We brainstorm together, and if nobody can come up with it, we break and we come back and we come up with an epiphany. I feel like some of our best games are actually things that we've sat on for like 3 years.
Wow.
Yeah. We come up with the visitor concept was originally 2013. We had this concept for a game, you know, it's modeling scientific process. Cool, let's try it. Oh, wow, this really didn't work at all. We shelved it, and then last year we came back to it. Well, actually 2 years ago at this point.
Yeah.
We were like, I had a thought. I was like, hold on, I'll bet this would work if. Came back to it, and suddenly everything's working.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
It's one of those, I don't know. Time is my favorite analog learning technology.
I love that answer in part because it runs up against the constraints that the kind of artificial constraints we put around education in colleges and universities, right? Here at Dartmouth, you have what, 10 terms, right?
That's awful.
That's your time, right? You don't have the luxury of time as a learning device, as a problem solving technology.
Yes, it's been nice.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Max. This is great.
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully that actually answered some of your questions.
That was Max Seidman, senior game designer at Tilt Factor, Dartmouth College's Game Design and Research Lab. The findings Max shared about construal level and agency are really interesting, and I can see a number of applications to the college classroom. I was also struck by the challenge Tilt Factor has in assessing the effects of the games they design. It's very similar to the challenge educators face in assessing learning in a variety of contexts. For more on Max Seidman, Tilt Factor, and the games they've designed, see the show notes for lots of links, including a link to that study Max mentioned about poverty simulations that don't always create the kind of empathy they're intended to. It turns out that, in some cases, watching someone else play through a poverty simulation is more effective than playing through it yourself. You'll also find a link to a blog series I'm writing on teaching board games, so if you're interested in the intersection of games and learning, you might want to check that out. To find our show notes, as well as past episodes with full transcripts, visit our website, leadinglinespod.com. We're on Twitter and Facebook, too. Just search for Leading Lines Podcast. We would love to hear how you use games and simulations in your teaching. Leading Lines is produced by the Vanderbilt Center for Teaching, the Vanderbilt Institute for Digital Learning, the Office of Scholarly Communications at the Vanderbilt Libraries, and the Associate Provost for Education Development and Technologies. This episode was edited by Rhett McDaniel. Look for new episodes the first and third Monday of each month. I'm your host, Derek Brough. Thanks for listening.